far and wide that it's like a spread spectrum thing when it oscillates. Without a spectrum analyzer with a high gain antenna and a low noise preamp, you can't even tell from a mile away or 5 miles away that the darn thing is oscillating. Over to you, Eric.
KTRI WK2J. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I can see that. No, that's not my goal, because I need to turn it back into video and do stuff with it before I send it out again. So, just I've been collecting all this junk, and I've actually started throwing some of it together, and it's beginning to work. I actually designed a new modulator for the AM portion of it, and I'm just about to make a board and make a bunch of them. That way, you know, you can hand them out to guys. They can put them together. It's a little kit. You just plug a camera into it, and you're all set. Anyway, move on. K2RIWK2J.
Yeah, obviously we'll discuss a lot of more of this on future weeks. Mel, you better grab the floor while you've got it, and did you get any emails from what we said last week? Were we able to answer anyone's questions, or did we just create more questions? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah, you have created quite a trouble here, Dick. I'm going to blame it all on you, because we got into this discussion last week, and I tried to explain a tool as simple as possible, and most people understand basically for the first time as to really what a tool is, and then you had to throw in a word called the Newton. And now you created another problem. What is a Newton? Here we go again. So, I'm going to leave it to you. Your fault. Go ahead with the Newton. Not Newtons. And it says it's not the Newton that he eats. Fake Newtons are delicious, but this is a different type of Newton. Over.
Yeah. When you do any work with electronics and you deal with foreign governments, you'll rapidly run into a problem. We are stuck in the English system. 90-some-odd% of the world is metric. We are very non-metric. So the vocabulary you use, like when I talk to my buddy, FOD, the guy in Chile, La Salina, Chile, all of a sudden I have trouble thinking of his name, his goal letters, other than that I know who he is. The guy who works at the European Southern Observatory, a beautiful optical astronomy set up on top of a mountain in Chile. Whenever I communicate with him by email, and I talk about inches, feet, miles, gallons, boy, do I get flack from him. Wow. He says, what the blank are you talking about? You're in the old-fashioned world. The whole rest of the world is into meters, kilometers, centimeters, millimeters, liters, grams, watts, joules, newtons, all of the units of the metric system. The whole darn world has gone metric, and the United States is sitting here as an isolated country saying, no, I don't have to do that. Well, yes you do. Stand by a minute. Whether you know it or not, we are in a global economy. It should be getting super clear to you now that when we run into financial grief, the whole damn world runs into financial grief. Another example is if you were running a company right now on Dover Street that's going to manufacture something, and you want it mass-produced at a low price, there's a high probability you would have it manufactured offshore. Maybe in Taiwan, Taipei, Taiwan, maybe in Shenzhen, China. Maybe the software would be done in Bangalore, India, or in Ireland. Maybe your high-tech components would be manufactured in Germany. But what I'm getting at is we are really living global by way of the Internet, by way of who can do the best manufacturing with the highest quality for the least price. You can say to yourself, I want to build and buy American only. You can say those words. There's a high probability if you say those words, you will be out of business in a year. Whereas if you decide that you're going to do it globally, once you accept the fact that global is the way, you stand a much higher probability of staying in business. But once you go global, you have to speak their language, and they are metric. You talk to them about the horsepower of your car, and they say, what the hell is that? They rate the horsepower of a car in watts or kilowatts. You talk about distances. They measure it in kilometers and meters and millimeters and angstroms and nanometers. They don't use micro-inches and inches and feet and yards and miles. They don't use those words. We measure force in pounds. We measure angles and degrees. That's one thing that we're together on. Angles and degrees is okay. But they don't measure force in pounds. They measure force in newtons. So, what is a newton? A newton is, I think it's 0.45 pound. It's a smaller unit than a pound. It is a unit of force. What's magic about the newton is that amount of force applied to something that is going to move through a distance of 1 meter creates an amount of energy dissipation or energy created of 1 joule. I know. All these
repeater, timeout, cancel.
All these units are tied together. Just like ohms and amps and volts are tied together. I mean, a volt is 1 amp through 1 ohm. Or I could say an ohm is 1 volt. If my resistor, when I put 1 volt on it, draws 1 ampere, I call it 1 ohm. So ohms, amps, and volts are all tied together. You know one, you describe the ratio of the other two. Well, the same thing when it comes to force, distance, and energy. They're all tied together. So, a newton meter, which is a force times a distance, a newton meter happens to equal 1 watt. A newton meter, stand by now, a newton meter is 1 joule. A newton meter per second is 1 watt. All you've got to do is write these things down, look them up with Google, and then by the time you get to Wikipedia, and you look up Joule, and you look up Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N is it, or N-E-W-T-O-N? I'm not sure of the spelling, as you can tell. But it is not the Fig Newton. It is Sir Isaac Newton, it's named after. It is a unit of force. The unit of mass that we often talk about could be measured in kilograms. You and I would like to measure it in pounds. The rest of the world lives in these other units. So, Newton is less than a pound. It's that magic number that when you push an object through 1 meter of distance, you dissipate 1 joule of energy if it's 1 newton of force required. And you do that continuously 1 newton meter per second. You and I call it 1 watt. So, I know that's not going to completely help. But by the time you hear it enough times, and you're going to have to slowly accept the fact that this world is going more and more global, you're going to have to think global, you're going to have to speak their language, and their language is metric. It's going to hurt, but we're going to have to go there. They fill up their automobile in liters of petrol, and it generates watts and kilowatts of power. When they drive through kilometers of distance, K2KEY, K2RIW,
KC2QIQ, you're 4-5 of the park. Did you see this?
Okay, very noisy signal that I couldn't get anything out of, but I did hear Glenn before that. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, in pounds of force, in other words, like we normally use, like, not to confuse pounds in terms of weight. In the metric system, they use, you know, grams and kilograms to measure weight. We use pounds. But then again, when you talk about force in pounds, then that's comparable to a newton. So when you talk about 1 pound of force is the equivalent to 0.2248 newtons. So actually it takes like a little over, at 5 newtons of force is a little bit more than 1 pound of force.
Yeah, in the beginning you said it backwards, but at the end you said it right. Newton is a smaller number than a pound. It takes a number of newtons to equal a pound of force. Newton is a force unit. It is not a mass unit. And the real scientists get real unhappy with us when we start using pounds in two different ways. I can talk about a pound of bread, and I'm talking about mass. I can talk about a foot-pound of force of torque that I put on a wrench, and there the word pound is meaning force. And for most of us, most of the time, we know what we're talking about, and they're almost the same. But to a real scientist, there's a real difference between a pound of mass and a pound of force. Even though I could be pressing with a pound of force on that scale, and the scale will measure 1 pound, or I could put a pound of mass on that scale, and the scale will read 1 pound, the average person will say they're the same. Well, a true scientist will say one is a force and one is a mass. And you're looking at the gravity effect of the mass when you put the weighty object on the scale. So, Newton, you can look it up with Wikipedia or Google, and it'll give you the exact definition. And I think it's in the vicinity of a quarter of a pound, or a little bit less, is a Newton of force, but it's a force unit. And I know that we haven't completely cleared up Joule, but a joule is a Newton meter is a watt second, is a good way of remembering it. 1 watt for a period of 1 second is a total amount of energy of 1 joule. A force of 1 newton through a meter of length is the amount of energy generated of 1 joule, the Newton meter. You have to hear these units a lot of times because we've all grown up with the other set of units. There was a period of time about 10 or 15 years ago that Shell gas station tried very hard to get us to go metric. And they were selling petrol in liters. And boy, everybody was complaining. KQKEY, KQRIW.
KQ, TSS.
TSS, go ahead.
Okay, call it TSS, Tangle Buckness here. And I'm in school. I'm a school student. Just so you know, they're beginning to teach the metric system more than they used to. In science, it's all metric. And in math, they're trying to use centimeters and millimeters more than the inch.
Okay, Mr. TFS. Good to know. But from your point of view, are the students accepting it or giving it a little bit of grief?
We find it annoying that we have to know two different measurement systems, but we like it because it's a lot easier than the English system.
Yeah, that was Danny, who lives in Dix Hills, and he's super loud on my input. Oh, it's a little bit noisy through the machine. But don't resist it, Danny. You're going to have to, in your technical career, accept the metric units. They're here to stay. Almost every single country in the world is metric. The only two outstanding countries that are almost non-metric are the United States, number one, a little bit of England, United Kingdom, and a little bit of Japan, a section of Japan. The whole rest of the world, you try to find a country that is non-metric of the 300 and some odd major countries in the world. I'll bet you I can come up with 290 of them are metric. We are the oddballs. We think we dominate. We think we're the king of everything. And we think whatever system units we use, we think the whole rest of the world should be using that. When it comes to our language, we sort of dominate. Of all the languages in the world, English is certainly a rather major language. It may not be the major language, but it is a major language. But when it comes to the scientific units, we are the oddballs, and it's not easy to accept that until you start talking to someone else internationally, and you'll rapidly find out if you're interfacing with that person on a technical basis, on scientific equipment, and you don't speak their metric language, you're going to have a huge language barrier, and you run into a lot of problems. And it's a humbling experience to find out that in that area, we are way down at the bottom of the list. We do not dominate. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let me back up this whole thing because I think we created more confusion than we fixed. So I'm going to try to get it down as much simpler explanationally so maybe more people will understand it. As we referred to Joule last week, really, as Dick said, the Joule actually has its beginning in the metric system. So when we talk joules, we are actually talking about a metric system where a joule and a watt, just as we had translated over, as I said, that a watt could be called a joule per second. In other words, all right, let me let it drop because I'm going to better explain a little further into this. There are three basic systems that are used in the scientific field. Let me remember the systems. Well, first of all, of course, we got our English system, as Dick says, that we're very used to, that measures by foot or length or by pound. It's going to be a hard sell, of course, to change people over from that. I don't think we're going to get these guys in the construction business like carpenters and all to start using metric rulers so soon, Dick. Okay, next. There is a... let me remember this now. There is another form that is used in science called the... was called the... I remember reading very much about this, called the CGS system. Was called the centimeters gram second. Actually, that came about, Einstein made that really more or less come into view because Einstein used that work in his relativity formulas and everything. He used the CGS system called the centimeters gram second. I believe that's what they call it, CGS. Am I correct, Dick?
I think so, and I'm not positive. And by the way, I just Googled the word Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, plus Wikipedia. You put those two words together, and you'll end up with a beautiful website that gives you lots of conversions of Newton, a Newton force unit, into lots of other units. And its exact definition is going to scare you. I better not go there. Over to you, Mel.
Exactly. That's why I'm trying to stay away from it. All right, I just mentioned the CGS system. And next, there is another scientific notation system called the MKS, Mary King Newton. That's meter, kilogram, second. This is basically what the electronic units that we work with are based on, believe it or not. So they actually were established, believe it or not, in France, the system for measurement. And it came about, actually, as I remember the history of it, with the downfall of King Louis XVI in 17, I think it was around 80, something, 90, but it's sometime there. And that was when... it's actually when we started adopting this system. A lot of people want to know what the derivation of it is, was. Now, let's get to a little further on. And let me let it drop. You can see I'm trying to take my time here, so I guess it's as straight as possible. The MKS system, as I said, known as the millimeter kilogram second, was the first began as the measure of Newton. Now, one Newton, basically, if I remember correctly, one Newton of force is, if exerted on, let's see, 1 kilogram of mass for 1 second of time, would bring, has no friction, let's say this kilogram of mass is sitting, it has been without friction. And if 1 kilogram is exerted of mass, and 1 second of time, if brought from a dead stop to a speed of 1 meter per second, that would be 1 newton. Again, let me see if I said this correctly. I got to get my cut. The mass, 1 newton of force exerted on 1 kilogram of mass for 1 second of time would bring from dead stop the mass to 1 meter per second. Am I correct, over?
Absolutely true. That was the number that I was afraid to say. Wikipedia defines a newton as 1 kilogram meter per second squared. And if you break that down, it means a kilogram of mass, a little bit over 2 pounds, with 1 newton of force, which is about a quarter of a pound. You do that for 1 second, that mass will now have been accelerated so that it is moving 1 meter per second of velocity. That's sort of the definition of a newton equals 1 kilogram times meter divided by second squared. Turns out all of these units are various combinations of kilograms, meters, and seconds, and units. They're all tied together in this complicated way. So you and I would know it as approximately a quarter pound of force is what a newton is. And by way of this exact definition, a guy in space can do an experiment and derive that amount of force. It doesn't even have to have any local gravity. By accelerating a block, by applying a force to it, and finding out how fast it moves. So that's the whole intent of these units, is to try to come up with universal definition that no matter where you do it, at the North Pole, at the equator, or in space, you come up with the same answer. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I'm trying to pull this all together as simple as I can in my mind. Okay, now, if we said an object at rest requires, let's say, 2 newtons to move it, and if the 2 newtons push the object 2 meters, we would say if we wanted to put it back to joules, this is where the translation comes back, so you'll understand. This would be required, the work required would be 4 joules. Let me say that again. We have 1 newton of force is required to move it, and the object requires 2 newtons to move it now, and it pushes it 2 meters. That would be the equivalent work of 4 joules. So you can see how joules ties back. We were saying that joules watts and everything like that. So in this case, being staying with the metric, we wouldn't say 4 watts. We'd say 4 joules. I think that's correct, Dick. Over.
That was absolutely correct. So your 2 newtons of force move the block 2 meters, and then it stopped. You stopped applying the force, and it stopped moving. You dissipated 4 joules when you did that. And if you did that during 1 second of time, believe it or not, you would have been dissipating 4 watts during that 1 second. So a joule is a newton, meter is a watt second. And they tie together in funny ways like that. So we can talk about rate of doing work. You and I live in the horsepower range, and we do that. Well, they live in the watt seconds range. 746 watts happens to be 1 horsepower. So you can see why their automobile engines are rated in watts and kilowatts. They don't respect the word horsepower. Simple as that. Over to you, Mel.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, when I was in Europe, Dick, they do use horsepower in their cars. That's one, that's an oddity, I guess, but for some reason they do use horsepower. But in scientific units, you're right, they don't use it there, but definitely with their automobiles, they do.
What country you were in when they used the word horsepower?
Germany, Italy, France, most of Western Europe.
I'm a little bit amazed by that, but I'll take your word for it. Back to you, Mel.
UPFS.
Go ahead, Danny.
I just talked to my father. There's another outstanding country that uses the English system. That would be Myanmar, Burma.
Okay, you said another country, and I missed that word. Give me that word again.
Myanmar, or Burma.
Okay. Boy, I'm not familiar with that. What continent is that country on?
Give me 1 minute. I can look at a map and find out for you. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay, we'll come back to you. Mel, you've got it.
Where, what country were you looking for, Dick?
Something that sounded like Myanmar.
Oh, Myanmar. That used to be, I believe, Borneo. That's I guess part of, I guess you can call it Southeast Asia, Dick.
Burma.
Burma. Okay, apparently it's Burma. You got it, Mel.
Oh, you're right, Burma. Yeah, I remember this. I've had some contacts with them. And, all right, where was I now? Okay, so, let me give another example. Let me think of another example here. That maybe, where was I? I lost my thought here. But, oh, okay, let's go back to watts again. If 1 watt of power would accomplish the job, say, in 1 second, that would mean that 1 watt of expending energy at that rate would be the equivalent to 1 joule per second. Again, let me say that right. Make sure I said it right, then I'll check on it. 1 watt of power could accomplish a job in 1 second would be the same definition of the 1 watt expending the energy at the same rate as 1 joule per second. All right? Is that a good tie together of watts and joules, Dick? Over.
Very close, but I think there's an error there. A watt is a rate of 1 joule per second. So if I'm continuously generating 1 watt of, let's say, RF energy, that is a joule per second. Well, I better call it a watt. A watt of power. A watt is a unit of power. If my transmitter is putting out 1 watt, that's the power of my transmitter, and I run it continuously, it is dissipating 1 joule per second. So a joule per second is a watt. Or another way of looking at it, a joule is a watt times 1 second. A joule is a watt for a period of 1 second. So we can't talk about joule per second equals watt per second. We can say a joule is a watt per second, or we can say a watt is a joule is a watt second. A watt for a second is a joule, and a joule is a joule per second is a watt. Do I have that right? A joule per second is a watt. A watt. I'm going to think about it. That easy, Mel. Got to you. Back to you. Yeah. A watt times the number of watts times the number of seconds is the number of joules. So in Mel's earlier example, if I had a transmitter that's generating 2 watts, and I run that transmitter for 2 seconds, assuming the transmitter is super efficient, how much energy have I taken out of my battery to do that? 2 watts for 2 seconds? My battery had to supply a minimum of 4 joules to do that, if it's a 100% efficient transmitter. You have to hear these units a lot of times in a row. In the United States, up until now, we've used them very little, and they're fairly unfamiliar. But the rest of the world has lived there for a long time. I was doing a calculation for my buddy with in Chile, giving him the example of helicopters flying and how much fuel they use, how much energy they were dissipating. And I was doing things in horsepowers for hours and gallons, and my goodness, did he give me flack. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, as I said, I think you may have doubled. I said that 1 watt expending energy at the rate is, the definition of 1 watt would be then expending energy at the rate of 1 joule per second. Is that a simple definition, Dick?
Give that man a cigar. You got it.
Okay, now let me keep this thought in my mind. So then, if we had 1 watt, and it takes us to accomplish this, whatever, it takes, say, 4 seconds. 1 watt takes the job, takes 4 seconds. If we double it to 2 watts, the job would take 2 seconds. And if we made it 4 watts, it would take 1 second. That's basically the way I can break it down, Dick. Go ahead.
And in every one of those cases, total energy dissipated I think would be 4 joules.
Yes, right. You finished it up. That's my next word. That's the best way. It's like you say, you're going to have to think metric. And I've had this problem, oh boy, dealing with other people, other countries and all. It's very frustrating at times, but I think we all just going to have to, like I say, get with it. This is, as you said, we're in an international situation now, and so we got to be able to, I'm afraid, talk their language. I know it's a hard sell, Dick.
Why is the resistor's power equation P equals I squared R or E squared R over R rather than P equals I times E? That's in it. KB2MAI. KB2MAI. I'm going to restate your question. KB2MAI. And by the way, in a quick break, what's your name, sir?
By the way, it's Romeo at the end. Name yours, Gabe.
Okay, M-A-R, and yes, you signed in before, Gabe. If I have, just to make things simple, a 1-ohm resistor, and I put 1 volt across it, Ohm's law tells you it's going to draw 1 ampere. 1 volt times 1 ampere means the resistor, during that event, is dissipating an amount of heat of 1 watt. Notice also that if I knew only the current of the resistor and its ohms, and I squared the current, 1 ampere squared is 1, I squared R. You're about to ask, how in the world is it I squared R, E squared over R, or IR? If you took I squared R and you calculate, let's see now, there's a way that you can break up the formula with I squared R, redefine one of those I's or the I square, and get the other form. Once you know how to manipulate that E equals IR, or I equals E over R, or R equals E over I, once you start doing substitution, you will come up with I squared R or E squared over R. So power, you could say, has got three different forms, depending on which units you want to use. Current times voltage, that's one way of assessing the power of a resistor. Another way is to square the voltage and divide it by the resistor. Another way is to square the current and multiply it by the resistor. So they are the same forms once you manipulate E equals IR, or I equals E over R, or R equals E over I. You take any one of those formulas and do a substitution, you will come up with the other formulas. That's the easiest way I know how to say why they're equivalent. I bet your Mel's got an easier way. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. Let's hear Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Amperes. Let's go back. We'll go back to amperes. Amperes originally was referred to the quantity instead of really the rate. And the symbol would have been Q. However, later on, they thought of amperes basically as the intensity, I believe, of current. And according to the, and then of course, the letter I came into the formula. And in ohms, and if you look in, basically, I believe it's basically based on Kirchhoff's laws, to symbolize it. It is based on the breakdown of Kirchhoff's law, Dick, basically, over.
That's true. If you Google the word ampere plus Wikipedia, you'll come up with, not so simple, but it is 6.24 times 10 to the 18 electrons. If that number of electrons, 6 times 10 to the 18, 6 with 18 zeros after it, if that number of electrons passes a particular point in your wire, then 1 ampere is flowing. And that number of electrons is also called an amount of charge, which is called 1 coulomb, and it's all tied together in another crazy way. I know I'm going beyond where I should have gone here, but that number of electrons, 6 times 10 to the 18 electrons, one coulomb of electrons, if you happen to put that number of electrons onto one plate of your capacitor, and if as a result your capacitor now has 1 volt of difference between its two plates, then that capacitor is defined as having 1 farad of capacitance. So they tie together in a funny way. And I know we're going a little bit off subject here, but Paul, WS2N, by the way, the latest issue, Paul, let me drop for a second. The latest issue of Scientific American has a beautiful article by Carolyn Porco of the Rocket Laboratory out in California. Why can't I think of it? You know who I mean. The main NASA site in California. She is on the imaging team of the Cassini satellite, the Cassini spacecraft, which I think was launched in, I believe, 1999. And it has been circling Saturn. And so the moon going around Saturn, which I think is Enceladus, is a moon that's only 300 miles in diameter, but it has ice on the surface. They have strong reason to believe it's got liquid water below the surface periodically, and the surface is covered with snow, and it's got water geysers squirting out of it. And with the measurements that Cassini has made, those water geysers squirting out of, you call them water volcanoes if you like, squirting out of this little moon Enceladus going around Saturn, those geysers contain organic compounds. They're seeing evidence of life on a moon going around Saturn. And that's in the latest issue, the December issue of Scientific American. Very nicely illustrated and described article. I haven't read it all yet. WS2N, K2RIW on the Tech Man.
Very good, Dick. And yeah, I like her. I've seen her on quite a few documentaries. And she comes out of the Bronx, so she's out of New York, so that's good. And they said also that Enceladus could be contributing to the makeup of some of the rings because of what it's doing. I haven't seen that report, Dick, with the organics. I'll have to look for that in American Scientific. Very good. I just wanted to comment about that. P equals the I deal, and the power equals I squared R. But before I do, you know, you mentioned the importance of the metric system and the English system. One of our spacecraft that went to Mars, they do blame on the problem of some engineers putting in English units and confusing it with another group putting into the same spacecraft uploading metric, and when the rocket thrusters went on this Mars climate orbiter that never went into orbit because it was lost, the firing was wrong because one group is thinking one group is thinking the other way. So if they got onto the same page, we might have had a Mars climate orbiter up there as well as the what we have up there today. The European Space Agency has a Mars Express. We have a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We'll have Mars Odyssey operating. Mars Global Surveyor, that thing quit. Let me drop it. In regard to the substitution for that, when you get power equals I squared R, I remember going through that. You have E equals IR, and then you have T equals E times I. If you substitute that E, because E equals IR, you take that I and the R and you substitute, and you wind up with power equals, I times, it would be, if you substitute in the E, now you're going to get another I and an R, so you would be power equals I times R, so they just combine the two and they wind up with the I squared power equals I squared times Z. I'm going through that, Dick. But exactly what you said, substitution. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, I'm going to start off with what I think is the simplest substitution. Most of us will recognize the fact that power equals current times voltage. Symbolically, we say E times I equals power. But I also equals E over R. So if in the original formula, P equals EI, I do the substitution for I equals E over R, then P equals E times E over R. That's a fancy way of saying E squared over R, and so on. Depending on which one you do the substitute, you can derive the other two formulas. So although they look strange, they really are equivalent. And once you do the substitution process, you'll probably convince yourself. By the way, the Scientific American December issue, and it was Jet Propulsion Laboratory, I couldn't think of, that Carolyn Parko works for. And yes, she's been on quite a few programs, particularly NASA Select. If you've got NASA Select, you'll see her being interviewed for long periods of time as various portions of the original Cassini mission were taking place, because she has major responsibility for the imaging that takes place on the Cassini mission. Let me drop. The European Space Agency is about to launch a spacecraft called the Planck spacecraft, P-L-A-N-C-K, named after a famous scientist, and it is going to do what the COBE, the background, C-O-B-E, COBE Background Explorer, I think it was called, was the first one, which was then upgraded by the WMAP, which stands for Wilkinson Microwave and Anisotropy Probe, which made measurements about 100 times or 1,000 times more sensitive than the COBE. And now the Planck is going to make a measurement of the total background radiation of the universe to 2.73 degrees Kelvin and all of its hot spots and cold spots. It's going to be done with much higher resolution with Planck, and therefore we're going to learn more and more about why the universe is, I think it is 5.2370-something. In other words, 5% of the whole universe is visible material, the stuff that your telescope can see. Let me drop. 23% of the universe is dark matter, which you do not see. The other 70-some-odd percent of the universe is dark energy, which you don't see, but all you know is it's creating acceleration of the material out at the perimeter. The stuff at the perimeter is moving away from us at ever-accelerating velocities. And they call it dark energy that's doing that. So right now, the best guess is the energy, the whole universe is 5% that you see, 23% that's dark, and 70% that's energy that, again, you're not seeing. We're only seeing 5%. If that turns out to be really accurate, I don't care if it turns out to be 4.9 or 5.3, but if that's true, wow, there's a lot of stuff we don't see. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Let me see if we can open another can of worms here that I'm going to get emails about. Let's see, where was I? You started with capacitance. I'm trying to remember. I should make notes here. The capacitance that we mentioned every so often and inductance actually are definitions of volt, ampere, and second. That's there, believe it or not, they do have that in common with the volt, the ampere, and second actually have in common the measurement of capacitance and inductance. So I don't know how much further I should go into this right now, but maybe we should we go any further, Dick, or you think this is it?
Well, for a second, for a few sentences, I'm going to jump into something that gave me a lot of trouble through high school and the first couple of years of college, and that is stored energy of a moving object is 1/2 mv². And the way I remembered it is that assume your automobile is moving 20 miles an hour and you run into a brick wall. Your car is going to be dented pretty heavily. If instead of moving 20 miles an hour, you're moving 40 miles an hour and you hit that brick wall, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, twice the velocity, hitting the same wall, twice as much damage. When you're moving 40 miles an hour instead of 20 miles an hour, and because stored energy is a function of velocity squared, and I square 20 instead of squaring 10, I get four times bigger number. When you hit that brick wall at 40 miles an hour, you get four times more destruction than when you hit it at 20 miles an hour. I had a lot of trouble with that. I had to go through a whole lot of derivations. And finally, when I saw one of the diagrams in that beautiful book that you can buy for $32, paperback book, which is in its 20th printing and third edition, it's called Thinking Physics by Epstein, Lewis Carroll Epstein, Insight Press. You go to a good Barnes & Noble store, and you look at that book. Every page has got a simple stick drawing and a couple of questions and the answer on the very next page. Stand by a second. That book will teach you physics so fast, you will learn joules, watts, coulombs, horsepower. But you'll learn these units in a way that's a lot easier to remember. When you see the right diagram and it becomes visual, man is a very visual animal. When you learn new material in a more visual manner, it'll make more sense, and your chances of remembering it are a hell of a lot more. So that's a darn good book. And so the fact that the energy dissipated by a resistor is E squared over R, or I squared times R, why should it be squared? And by the same token, when it comes to stored energy in a moving vehicle, it's a function of velocity squared. When it comes to the stored energy in a capacitor, it's 1/2 cv². cv². The voltage that you put on the capacitor, you square it, you multiply it by the capacitance in farads, that's the total number of joules of stored energy. These many farad capacitors that you can now buy in a bubble pack at Radio Shack, they make beautiful batteries. There are guys that are flying small, ultra-miniature, radio control model airplanes on indoor events. By not using a battery, they use a farad capacitor instead to run the motor that turns the propeller on this indoor model airplane. When it comes to how much energy is in your lithium ion battery, it's usually rated in the ampere hours. Well, that's not real energy. That tells you how many amps for how many hours. You have to know how many volts to really know the energy. Got to do another multiplication. But so you can power your airplane with a lithium battery, or nowadays you can power it with a capacitor. And the stored energy in the capacitor is 1/2 cv². You can store energy in a inductor. The current that you put into an inductor makes a magnetic field, and that is stored energy. And you stop putting that current into the inductor, you disconnect the wire to it while current is flowing, and you'll get a spark. We call it the inductive kickback. That's how a Ford spark coil works. That's how the ignition coil works in your automobile. You put current through that coil, it stores a magnetic field, you interrupt it, the voltage comes back at a real high voltage, and it makes an arc across your spark plug. But the stored energy in that inductor, which is your spark coil, is 1/2 Li². 1/2 times the inductance times the current squared. So a lot of these phenomena have something squared to it, which is at first hard to accept. The best way at the beginning is just to memorize it and believe it. But you can easily rate how much energy is in a capacitor, how much energy is in a inductor, how much energy is in a battery, and there are times when these, how much energy is in a moving vehicle. And if you understand conservation of energy, you'd be amazed how many very complicated problems suddenly become easy. You could have a marble rolling down a very complicated shaped V-curve, if you know what I mean. A curved surface, you got a marble rolling down it. And assuming the marble rolls without friction, you can talk about the increase in velocity for each portion of that curve that the marble is rolling down. And it would be a very complicated problem. As long as you know ahead of time that the marble is rolling without friction, all you have to do is know what is the height change from beginning to end of the event, and how heavy is the marble. You therefore know exactly how much kinetic energy has been given to that marble, and if you want, you can then calculate its exact velocity.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So I'm giving that as an example of what looks at first like a very complicated problem. Like say, for instance, you push your child backwards on a swing, and while the child is on the swing and the rope is at a 45 degree angle, you let go. And as the swing swings down from 45 degrees to 40 to 35, all the way down to 0 degrees, it's a curved path that the child is swinging on that swing. And you can calculate how much energy was given by each portion of that curve because of the slope of the curve that the child was traveling through while that swing swung. That's the complicated way. A more simple way is to just say, hey, when I pushed the child backwards at the 45 degree angle, the child was 1.5 feet further above the ground. And when the child swings all the way down, they have lost 1.5 feet of altitude and the child weighs 100 pounds. You can calculate exactly how much energy was put into the child and therefore what is the velocity of the child at the bottom of the swing. A very complicated problem becomes very simple when you understand some of these laws of conservation of energy. And so in order to use those laws, you're going to have to know how much energy is stored in a battery, how much energy is stored in a capacitor, how much energy is stored in an inductor, how much store energy in a moving object. All of these will eventually come together and really help if you wanted to know. And when you drop that screwdriver from the top of your radio tower, and you'd like to know how fast is it going to be moving when it strikes the ground, how much damage could it do if it hit somebody, as crazy as that sounds, you can do a very exact calculation of that with some of the concepts that Mel and I are now discussing. I've done that experiment. I've dropped my glasses. I've dropped almost every tool that I own from the top of my tower inadvertently over the years. I bet you've dropped a couple of tools, Mel. Maybe you tie your tools to your body and you're a little smarter. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I'll probably step away there. Just want to comment about that book, Thinking Physics. I thought back at that book when I was watching Mythbusters, and they decided to separate two telephone books. They had two telephone books. They interlaced each page with one another. The idea was to pull them apart. Well, they, you know, as you pull two of them apart, they tend to lock together, and they were getting into bigger and bigger extraordinary ways of pulling them apart. They got to the point where they got two cars, and they attach one book to one car and the other book to the other car. And I'm pulling you apart with two cars. And I thought back to the Thinking Physics book. And, they really don't need to do that. All they needed to do was find, like, a concrete wall and attach one book to the concrete wall and then just use one car and pull the same mile per hour. And it would be the equal amount of force. But they show that in that book. They have everything very pictorial, and they show that there's no difference between, you know, two horses pulling something apart equals the same amount of pressure on that object as if you were to attach it to a wall or something and just use the one horse that it was. But excellent book. Anybody that doesn't have it, that's interested in that topic, I'm going to concur 100% with you, Dick. I have it, and I think it's great. Back to you, WS2N.
Paul, how long ago did you buy the book? What store? And did you pay about $32 for it? And who told you to buy it?
Dick, I think you bought that up years ago, and it's been sitting here quite a while. Price, I can go, maybe look at the back. Maybe it usually has the price, but it's probably in that area. Mine's a soft cover book, so maybe it's not as much, Dick.
Every single edition is a soft cover Army Blue book. And do you think yours is the third edition?
Let me look.
A darn good book, and I strongly recommend it. I wish that when I was taking physics in high school and physics in college, that they used that book as an auxiliary book, auxiliary textbook, because quite a few of the concepts that were being showed in my college textbooks were kind of hard to swallow. I had trouble with some of them. And if I had that Epstein book to look at the same time, it would have become a lot more clear. It's much more visual. Many college textbooks just have page after page of great big complicated equations. And there are times when trying to figure out what they're saying is not easy. Some of the more modern textbooks are using more computer-generated graphics, and it helps a lot. But that Epstein book is the ultimate. It's a soft-covered book, $32. If you're ever going to work in anything scientific, I think you want a copy of it. Let's see if Paul is back.
Yeah, Dick, $33.95, third edition. Yes, it is.
You've got the latest and the greatest. And you look at the first few pages, you'll see that that book has been reprinted about 20 times. Very popular book. Let's see if Mel has come back. WK2KEY, K2RIW. Sorry I got into so long-winded, so many other subjects, Mel. I'm wound up tonight.
I've had it since 2002, Dick.
Wow. My guess is he's probably getting ready for the fourth edition. Very popular book. I own both the second edition and the third edition. And it was a man who worked in the physics department of my previous company that brought that to my attention. Actually, he worked in the optical department. And there's a whole bunch of stories there. Do we have anyone on frequency with any further questions or comments while we're waiting for Mel? Maybe Mel had a problem with his transmitter, or maybe he got called away. So if you've got any further questions or comments of anything that has occurred tonight, give us your call letters right now. And if Mel, if you're there, you can come back. Whoever would like to, you got it.
Okay. See if I got it.
You sure do. And you were missed.
Okay. All right. Now, I heard Paul come back on, so I sort of stood by. Let's finish up one more thing. Let's see. Dick brought up a very good subject there with thought. That's why if you're in a car, wear your seatbelt and safety harness. Because if that car is even going, say, 10 miles an hour and hits a so-called brick wall or a tree or whatever, you will be propelled forward and you cannot stop yourself from going through through the windshield. Basically, even at, say, 10 miles an hour, maybe even at 5 miles an hour, Dick, over.
Yeah, the way I word this, and I've given this little mini lecture to a number of the people I work with, this one very smart guy I work with, who is positive that the seatbelt is dangerous. He's got nightmares that he's going to be in a car and can't get loose after an accident because he's tied down by the seatbelt. And so, in order not to get a ticket, he wears his seatbelt, and he was involved in an accident a few years ago. He saw the accident coming. And as the accident was about to proceed, he disconnected his seatbelt. His knees jammed into the, and it was a rather minor accident, his knees jammed into the dash panel and got cut. His chest hit the steering wheel real hard. His head hit the windshield. This was a minor accident. Arnold Schwarzenegger would have great difficulty taking a modern car, sitting on the inside of the car, and kicking his foot through the windshield. A modern-day windshield is a very strong item. That very strong guy would have great difficulty. It would probably take him 10 kicks of his foot to make a hole in that windshield. And yet, without a seatbelt, a high percentage of the people have their head go through that windshield. And if you calculate the forces on your spine and on your cranium when that happens, it'll scare the daylights out of you. Every accident consists of two accidents. The first accident, your car strikes a solid object and decelerates rapidly. But you are a free-floating object in that car if you don't wear a seatbelt, and you keep moving ahead, at 60 miles an hour when the car has stopped. Therefore, you strike the inside of your car at a 60 mile an hour speed. From your head's point of view, that windshield is almost a brick wall.